The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Deborah Winger, as all of you know, since you're here tonight, is one of America's great actresses. Her roles in Shadowlands and Officer and a Gentleman and Terms of Endearment garnered wide praise and 3 Academy Award nominations. Now she's written her first book, a very personal look into her creative life, called Undiscovered. And we're very fortunate to have her here tonight to discuss the book and her creative process with Maya Danziger. When Deborah writes that she is interested in the process of aging as an unfolding of some mystery, it is a good description also of her book. Her poetics of unfolding moments in her life, the life of a consummate artist, a wife, an artistic collaborator, a mother, a daughter, a global citizen who works with nonprofit organizations that promote social change and mutual understanding, and a farm dweller who knows how to mow a field of rye. Maya Danziger is an Emmy Award-winning actress who has appeared on and off Broadway, on television and in film. She's the founder and former artistic director of the Actors Company Theater in New York. She's been teaching writing workshops, Relax and Write, for the past 15 years. I've talked to many people who've taken Maya's workshops, and she is indeed an inspiring teacher. She runs weekly private classes in Los Angeles and also teaches workshops for a variety of organizations. And she specializes in working with writers and artists on developing their creativity. She's also been for many years a volunteer teacher at the Bunn Children's Home in Dulanji, India. So please enjoy tonight. I think it will be quite special. Please welcome Deborah Winger and Maya Danziger. Thank you.
Hi.
Welcome. Welcome to all of us. And welcome to you. What a treat.
Thanks for having me.
I was going to start in a whole other way, but we just had an adorable thing backstage that I wanted to share with the audience. If you guys are here thinking that Deborah has written an ordinary memoir, like a little tell-all Hollywood thing, turn back, go away. It's so totally not that. It's a beautifully crafted kind of meditation, actually, on, as I see it, on the artistic process, on living your life as an artist, and kind of then choosing to live your own life as a work of art. Deborah has been traveling all over, looking for her book in nice little places, and she just told a story of a...
Oh. I say,
where are we heading?
I've been, you know, to several different cities so far, and the independent bookstores have been great. Great experience. I go in, one of the staff has written a personal review, and you know, it's sort of how you imagine would be your dream of it. And then I ventured into, I guess, Barnes & Noble, thinking, okay, well, this, but I'll see it. Maybe I get a, you know, 3 days on the front table or something, whatever, whoever's paid whoever to get on the front table. And I can't find the book, so that's a little depressing. You know, like the day it came out, you'd think maybe. I can't find the book, so I thought, okay, well, I'll mosey back to a section, and it'll be, you know, in this section. So I start with, like, what I would like it to be in, essays. It's not there, of course. So I go over to, like, well, I'll accept if it's in biography. Okay, it's not really a biography, but I understand if they... not there. And then they have like famous people biographies. Like, I cringe, but I know I'll find it there. It's not there. So I'm really stumped, you know, and I finally find some person that works there and, you know, of course had no clue where the book was because, you know, if you've ever been in Barnes & Noble and asked for help, they go to the computer and they said, no, we have a lot of copies. It's in self-help. Oh, I just, you know, like my whole future flashed in front of my eyes because I thought it's like a junk food defense in a courtroom. Like somebody really in need of help went into Barnes & Noble and ended up with my book and killed five people. And their defense was that they got, you know, my book in the self-help section. So we're really trying to get it out of there.
Well, there is an almost kind of Zen quality, though, to the structure of the book. And I really did want to ask you, how did you decide on your approach for doing this? Because it's really very particular. And
well, you know, like those sushi chefs that can throw up the stuff and like cut it in the air. It really was random in a way. I know what I didn't want. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of things work well in life when you know what you don't want. And then you sort of leave a little bit of it up to chance. But I knew I didn't want anything chronological because that doesn't reflect how I think. And so after that, they sort of started to take some... I started grouping pieces together that came from the same place that when I wrote them. Like somewhere made, you know, came from the same need to write. And when I saw those groupings, then I started to imagine what kind of door you would walk through to get to that place where those stories lived. And that's how the illustrations happened. So they're really not chapters. They're groupings of stories that happen at really different times.
Mm-hmm. And
some of them at no time.
To mention these doorways, the beautiful illustrations in the book by the famed tightrope walker Philippe Petit.
Yeah, because, you know, whenever you need illustrations, you call an aerialist.
I was going to ask you about that.
Everybody knows that. I learned that in writing school.
What made you think of him for this?
Well, you know, he became a friend after a story that actually closes the book. I wrote about this story. He was always sort of a hero of mine from afar. I sort of used him. He was the metaphor for everything for me. Mostly don't look down. But so I followed his career for years, and then I proposed to write an article for the New York Times when he was going to walk across the Grand Canyon, and he canceled that walk, and I just went nuts, and I wrote this article anyway, and then I called him. And we became friends ever since. So we share this passion for doorways. When he travels, he sketches them in his book, and they were much better than my drawings. So
it seemed really a natural kind of
collaboration. Well, we kind of collaborated on the places because there were some places that we had both been, and so there are doorways that exist and some of them that are made up.
So early in the book, you you tell a story of a near-death experience you had when you were 17, and you said something that really struck me, which is that you kind of described by the end of your whole little saga, some of which is quite actually funny, that you really describe it as a kind of a message from the universe.
Yeah, you know, my son had an injury a few years ago playing basketball, and I realized on the way to the hospital in the ambulance that he was exactly the same age as me. Wow. And he had a head injury, and his was not serious, as mine ultimately was not, but my experience of it was enormous. And I think that's what I finally worked out over the years, was the disconnect between other people's perception of it and mine. And I think in life, you know, we have these moments that wake us up. And sometimes it looks like nothing to somebody else. Sometimes it's the passage of someone else, you know, that we just experience secondhand. But they are like, you know, the proverbial bamboo stick. They just, for some reason, they are transformational, like a seminal event. And that's what that accident was. I mean, it wasn't an accident because I can't imagine my life if it didn't happen. It was a mortality sandwich, and I ate it. And I knew from that day on that nothing was as I had thought it was up until then, 17.
So moving into, I mean, not too many years after that, you know, your career really takes off and you become the flavor of the month. Did you have a sense that
what a long month it was.
A long month. And a long and beautiful month. But did you really have a sense that you were, that this was part of a kind of a plan, that you were marked to be out in the world? Or is this
that's a good
marked
one.
For something
marked,
else,
like
perhaps
a target?
Mm-hmm.
No.
No. Okay.
It's a good answer.
It was
as shocking to me as, you know, it was to my parents. I mean, it was just weird. It's weird. It's just a weird thing to happen to have that kind of success, especially doing what you love. Like, you think, I just always figured I'd be working to support doing this thing. So it was a great gift, you know, to be able to do what you love. What ended up sort of evening the score was the celebrity of it, which, you know, some people like. For me, it was the payment that I had to make each year to be able to do what I love.
Well, I mean, one of the things that comes across so beautifully in the book is really, you know, you're so generous about what the creative process is to you. And I think one of the hallmarks of your work, at least in my mind, and I'm pretty sure in everybody else's mind, is this level of authenticity that you've always brought to your characters and to your work as an actress. I mean, you're fierce about it in your performances. And sometimes that's raw and very, very exposed. And, you know, suddenly here you are, raw and exposed in a world that...
Deborah Winger, raw and exposed.
Well, you that talk about...
That should have been the name of the book.
There you go.
Wouldn't have been in self-help.
There you go. Well, you talk about developing a kind of persona to send out into the world to sort of protect that. I'm wondering, you know, in terms of the level of vulnerability and the level of intense dedication to the work itself. I mean, you have this beautiful metaphor you use of what you say. You say you wanted the pony and not the merry-go-round. And the pony
well, it wasn't
is the
so
horror.
Much that I want, I that I, you know, I just... It, I was after the pony, you know, unexpectedly. You know, it's sort of like, you know, you get this big, beautiful, nobody would complain about the beauty of a merry-go-round and the fun of riding it, but, you know, if you think about it in metaphor, you go around and around on a hard metal thing. And I wanted something hot and sweaty that ran. But, you know, I just sort of, that metaphor for me was not to begrudge it totally. It was just that at the time that it wore out, it really wore out. And to be honest with myself, and luckily, I think probably, I don't know, the way I was brought up or what had a great impact on me when I was young, the people that I met, the money just wasn't the deal. You know, because it does get kind of addicting. Oh, you know, well, you could just live this much greater or do this bigger thing, and you go after that.
What about the work?
Well, you know, the work doesn't always equal the success. In fact, you know, I think it's kind of like a squeaky machine that you have to keep oiling in that kind of success. And so those, you know, I'm going to carry this metaphor into oblivion. It gets greasy. No, I mean, I wasn't finding an accurate reflection in the work. I mean, the year that I did two films one year that I loved. I did Shadowlands, which, you know, was one of the most literate scripts I got to do. I'm so grateful that I hung out to do that. And I did Dangerous Woman, which was a wonderful experience for me as well. And then I just felt this change that happened. That was like the mid-90s. Mm-hmm. And the scripts I was reading suddenly, were quite different than those two. Mm-hmm. And I started to think, you know what? How at what point do you go the ratio? Like, okay, you're willing to do one or two that are not, you know, that you can't always hold out. But the ratio was not getting better. Mm-hmm. And I was getting anxious to have my life feel as full as it had when I was doing good material. And I just realized that I wanted to make other things.
And what were the other things that you wanted to make?
I didn't know. So I made this book. I didn't know I was making it, but I started writing. So and then I made it into a book. So you don't always know what you're making. You just have to trust something, which I think I probably got from people like my mentor, Jim Bridges, and just gave me a sense of trust. Like, whatever it is that you're doing, just trust that if you're really doing it, it's going to come to something. You know, it may not look like much at the time, So, and I was, you know, I put doors in the forest. I mean, really, if you're doing something, I had gardens that, you know, blew my mind. I know that sounds maybe, you know, to somebody who doesn't garden, it really sounds boring. But if you're making something, it's big. Well, and you don't always record it, that's all. Yeah. Theater is, you know, I was doing theater, and it was great for me not to have it recorded. It was great for me to run into people that said, I was there that night. Mm-hmm. And not have any proof of it. I mm-hmm. loved that. I had not had that experience because I didn't come from the stage.
Yeah. I was going to ask, actually, the question really, if it had really just been about the acting, if there hadn't been celebrity attached to it, if you'd just been, you know, a growing, developing actress, I mean, you know, speak of not having had a lot of training when this all happened for you and all of that. If it had really just been about the work, do you think it would have been a different story for you?
I can't go there. I don't know, because I think the reason I got those roles, it became
a circle.
I have no idea. I know that the roles were big enough and enough for me to do that they kept my mind busy. And sometimes when I've tried to do something less, when I was trying to do, it wasn't enough mm-hmm. for me to feel satisfied. So, you know, then I could go do Chekhov or write a book, and that was enough.
So what made you decide? I mean, when was the moment you knew that it was just time to really pick up and do the whole?
It wasn't really a moment, but I did for years live with the little yellow card that they used to send out from the Screen Actors Guild that said, you know, for any reason, if you know you're not going to work for a while, please sign this card and send it in, because then they put you on some special thing for insurance. And I had the card taped to my medicine cabinet mirror for about 3 years. Today?
Awesome.
One day I just signed it and mailed it off. I don't really remember why.
An enormous part of the book deals with motherhood, with your becoming a mother, your being a mother, your having a mother. Now, you became a mother for the first time when you were still actively in the business, and then you became a mother the second time when you were no longer.
No, once you're a mother, you're always
a mother. Yeah.
You don't become a mother the second time. But, yeah, I did have another child much later.
What was the difference in the experience at that point for you, when you'd really allowed yourself the time to really be in this other world, in this other life?
You mean the difference in raising them?
Yeah.
They were both, you know, completely hair-raising. I think it's a little bit older for anybody out there that had a kid, you know, a little bit later than what the expected age is. You know, you sort of waddle in there and go, you know, well, I don't know. It's just a different sentiment to waking up in the middle of the night. You get the bottle, I'll get my teeth. I don't know. You just feel a little bit like, maybe this isn't the age we were supposed to do this. But then, you know, once you get over that, it's kind of great to have a little guy around the house.
Did you get what you were looking for by moving away?
Thank goodness I wasn't looking for anything. Because anytime I set out looking for something, I never feel like I found mm-hmm. it. It never feels like, aha, this is exactly what I wanted. I think that kind of, for me, that kind of ambition only led to pain. I think that for me it was more like a riptide. Life is like more like a riptide. You just relax and float.
Did being in the country allow that? I mean, you write really beautifully, and I'm going to ask you to read a section of here, but you really do write so beautifully about being in the natural rhythms, about really allowing yourself to have the time, what the country gives to you.
Lived out there, I mean, chores are pretty, the pressure of the seasons is pretty intense. I mean, I wasn't living the life like, oh, if I don't get the corn in, you know, but I did not have somebody running our farm, you know, running our the place that we lived. So there were certain things that if you didn't get it done, you know, if you don't chop the wood, you pretty much don't have the fire. So there is a certain element of connectivity with that kind of life. To have a country house is different, you know, but to live in the country is very real.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if maybe you would read us a little section about being in your garden and how that sort of hooks up with some of your process.
Oh, okay. By the way, my garden looks like hell because I'm here. So this year, this doesn't apply. I would be so embarrassed if, like, you know how, like, they follow famous people with it in helicopters to get, like, a shot of their wedding or whatever? If they really wanted to out me, they would get an aerial shot of my garden this year and go, "She's a hoax. This is all made up." Gardening. Gardening is much like directing. So much is in the casting, the passion that the actor has for the opportunity to tell the story. When I put a plant into my garden, if I place it incorrectly, I can water it, feed it, talk to it, coddle it, and not only will it not give forth, I may not be able to save it from dying. On the sunnier side, or the shadier, if that's what is needed, if a plant loves its place in the garden, it will not be stopped. You can feed it and help strengthen the blossom or intensify the color, but it will have no other imperative but to bloom. The earth, as it spins now, is a pretty precarious place to live. I find that making changes of a smaller nature can often have a prismatic effect. Planting a garden is one thing, creating something from a dream. Watching it grow is another. A morning glory I planted one summer knotted itself over and over and turned in on itself and headed back down for its roots. I should have corrected it, but I was fascinated by the mistake. I was more interested in the metaphor. We have a stand of poplar trees that people have been telling my husband and me will not last the winter. They've been saying that for 15 winters now. I always sit in front of the window and watch the beautiful two-sided leaves applaud the first fall breezes. A curtain call, I think. But then, there they are once again, clapping in the spring. Underneath the trees that will not die is another story. No matter what I plant there, it will not thrive. When I have to go away, I return to a miasma of weedy vines and nondescript chokers. This year, after giving up for the last few seasons and letting the weeds have their way, I found some bright red plump raspberries. What wanted to be a wild raspberry patch and a stand of poplar trees had come into its own. Why does it take so long to uncover what seems so essential once it is revealed? I take turns in my life all the time. I feel an unshakable need to search, to dig deeper, to reveal, and to yield. Throughout these years, I have tended gardens, and doing so is one of my deepest times for reflection. I have planted them upon births and deaths, although the latter takes me to the soil most naturally. In the melancholia of a colorful fall, when an ancient dread is brought in with the first hint of chill in the breeze, tulips, daffodils, crocus, any sort of bulb, confirm one's trust in the spring. No need for the panic that sends squirrels on suicide missions for a single acorn. Knowing the bulbs are there, sleeping under the snow, has helped me during those long days of dull white sun and single-digit winters. I guess moving to a place that actually experiences definitive seasons is a vote for metaphor. It is a hearty thumb up, hopefully green, to the knowledge that our brain cannot get us out of every mess that it gets us into. In fact, I often wonder if the brain's very nature is to keep us from acknowledging our other sources of strength, a ruler, tyrannical to the point of debating religion, acts of faith, and trust from the heart. All these issues can be found in the smallest of gardens.
That might be why you wound up in self-help.
Yeah, that did kind of sound self-help. Yeah.
Well,
not all
but,
like it,
but it's quite beautiful and quite true, and there's something so, you know, deep about your commitment to living life from that place and to throwing yourself into the metaphor of it.
Do you know about memes?
Yes.
I've been really, you know, this has been my latest obsession is memes. So I'm convinced that, you know, there's nothing really new. We just are transferring information, and that in some way writing the book was sort of like, okay, it's out of my wheelhouse now. You know, send it on its way to... So I guess in that way, I resented the self-help thing because I thought, you know, well, what makes something, you know, in neuroscience? Like I'm helped by everything that I've read in neuroscience. So, that, you know, I guess I could get a degree and get doctor in front of my name. That would make the difference between self-help. And
I think there's something incredibly beautiful, though, about the fact that you've actually just chosen to live your life trusting. It's a lot of trust to walk away from what the world offers you.
Trust or stupidity? You'd be the judge.
Well, it's always a question, you know, and I think all of us in our lives face those transitions and challenges and those... instincts from deep inside that are often very, very hard to listen to. And the courage to really go for it and go for the not knowing of what that's going to bring to you. Go for the not having the agenda. You know, I think you and I were just talking back there a little bit about what had happened after 9/11 when you were in New York and how many actors showed up to just be there with...
A few more workers, yeah.
The workers. You know, by having a certain measure of celebrity, you have access. You have access to give and to give, you know,
experience. I am grateful for that aspect. I hate the beating that, you know, sometimes you take for, you know, whatever people perceive that as. But the truth is that I've had incredible opportunities to, you know, travel under the auspices of doing, you know, when I hear the word humanitarian, I sort of get hives because, I mean, I learned very early on that when I go out there to do something ostensibly that others would call humanitarian work, it is so selfish. I get so much out of it. I meet incredible people, people that are much stronger, much more talented, have wherewithal that I would never dream to be able to have in the face of adversity. And, you know, I get to meet them because of that. So that's the big secret is it's really, you know, it's the opposite of...
Well, it's very beautiful. And what you offer in that generosity as a kind of a spiritual path, I think is really quite astonishing. You were raised in was your family Orthodox or
no,
just observant?
My grandparents were.
Yeah. So there was a strong connection to
Yeah,
the,
I was
to
very
Judaism.
Close with my grandmother and grandfather when I was young.
Well, there's a beautiful section where you write about walking with them in their hands, you know, which is about language and writing.
Which I just found out there's a spelling error in that subject.
Oh, well, there you are. Everybody run right to your books
and look
for it.
You go through this, like, you know, incredibly, you know, creative period where you write the book, and then you go through this really intense period where you, you know, find yourself in the copy editing, you know, when somebody actually wants to publish your book for some reason that you'll never understand. And then, you know, you're studying the etymology of words, and that's really exciting and all that. And then the book goes out in the world, and you show up for your first press thing, and the woman goes, you know, on page 38, that park is not spelled K-A-N-E.
I didn't read that carefully.
Other night I shook the book in front of an audience and said, because I was quoted in New York, and I said, I did not mention the word prostitute anywhere in this book. And in the line of people that came up for a signature afterwards, one woman said, actually, the word is in the book. You know, it was not used in the way that I meant.
But there is a deep sense of spirituality in the book. And
see, I'm trying to move you off.
I know, but I'm not going anywhere. I just I'm wondering whether, you know, is that influenced by your grandparents in that sense?
Certainly, I wouldn't use the word spirituality where my grandmother was concerned. She was deeply religious.
Mm-hmm. Say no more.
I guess you got it. She was a fundamentalist. It was great, though. I mean, it really does. It gives you something very strong when you're young. First of all, I think that kids really do love ritual and structure. Mm-hmm. So I think there's absolutely nothing wrong with it to a point, you know, and it was great for me to shove off of. Had I not been given the alternative by my parents who moved away from that and shed it, I might not have known you had a choice, and that could have been dangerous. Mm-hmm. So I was really lucky to have a choice between the two, and I think that had my grandmother not been so harsh, I might have been more attracted to organized religion. But boy, those rules, man, I have a hard time, you know, with the hours that the library's open. So you can imagine. Too many rules.
You went through, in your period of disillusion, there's really a fun scene where you describe meeting Jerzy Grotowski, who's actually somebody I studied with at NYU. He terrified me. You said that he really blew you away at that time.
Let me just
say who these people are. He's a very famous Polish theater director who has...
He was sort of the start of a movement, really, back towards... I mean, in a way, it was... He'd turn in his grave if he heard Stanislavski in the same sentence. But some people would make that connection, sort of, you know, way of in which to work. And you pretty much committed your life if you worked with Jerzy, so... But I did have the good fortune to meet him through Jim Bridges, and it was sort of like, you know, the antidote to what I was in the middle of at the height of whatever, the craziness of Hollywood. Here was this guy that was actually teaching acting, so that was great.
The sense of authenticity, which I guess was...
Yeah, he used to bring in people from other cultures and study them and, you know, bring them to the theater, put them in the piece. And so you learned about these cultures and, it, you know, just sounds really boring talking about it. But you could Google him.
Now, I was really... You start
Isn't
the
that
book
great
in a...
You can Google Jerzy Grotowski.
But you can get a lot of wrong stuff when you...
Yeah. Really?
I got a lot of wrong stuff about you. You start the book with a drawing of a lover's knot.
Yeah, that's a great drawing that Philippe did. That was just something that I thought as a safety net, no pun intended, talking about Philippe, because he doesn't ever use one of those, but I thought as a safety I would, if I was actually going to get this book published, that I should have something that I could really say you could learn from it. Maybe that's
which was
why
to actually make a lover's knot.
To be in the sailing section. It's actual instructions for making this knot, which is actually a fisherman's knot, but it has come to be known as the lover's knot. It's two, you know, exactly matching, intertwining. Has to be of equal tension, and it's very easy to tie with wet hands.
And you do say in the book that most of the lessons that you've gotten in life, or the important lessons, have come from love. And there's...
Or the lack thereof.
Well...
Or the looking for it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'd be with John Lennon on that one. I just think it's probably the, you know, even whether it's through loss or through opening your heart or through letting go of stuff, it's always... because you love something or someone. Mm-hmm. I never learned very much from hate. That, you know, maybe you could learn the name of a really good doctor eventually, because that's what you need.
Also at the beginning of the book, there's that beautiful quote from the script of Shadowlands, and I was really curious as to why you wanted to open with that.
That was a suggestion from an editor. Didn't bubble up from me to give David Outerbridge his first of all, he wanted to call that's the deal, which is a line from Shadowlands, and you know, I just couldn't believe what a bad title that was. So we had a really big fight about that, and because of that, I came to look at the script to see why he was so strong, you know, otherwise great suggestions, and this one was like so bad that I had to figure out what his impulse, and I went back and read the scene that leads up to that line in the movie, and I was was a great scene.
It is a great
scene. So I thought, you know, I sort of did it for David, but it is the deal. So that's it's only because it just really was a literate William Nicholson script, great script. And I think I really do live by that. And since I was going to indulge in about a third of the book being about, you know, loss and sort of a recounting of the mother-daughter relationship, that I should probably say, you know, this is not doom and gloom that I'm talking about. This is the deal.
Well, the deal being that the joy you have in the moment has to be offset by the loss at the end or the love that you have.
Or vice versa.
A large portion of the book is, and a very beautiful portion, is spent around that mother-daughter relationship and the loss of your own mother. Set it all, go buy the book.
I think, you know, ambivalent relationships are ripe for, you know, writing. You can, anyone that's ever had, you know, relationships that go in, but that are just not copacetic and easy, and you know, you'd all have a book in you.
Yeah, but there's also an enormous amount of tenderness and showing up for it. I mean,
that's the nature of ambivalence. Yeah. It's both.
So, I mean, it's really I was exceedingly moved by that piece of the book, having had a mother myself.
Really?
Yes.
Well, that's such a something we
have something in common. It's really kind of amazing. Boy.
Stumped, huh?
You stumped me, girl. You did. You're a good one. You're a good one. There really is this sense of the question of all of these transitions, and I guess maybe the first question I want to ask before I ask you that is, you clearly have been writing for a very long time, because there's material in this book that goes.
I basically write myself out of a scrape, and I've been getting into scrapes, you know, as long as I can remember. So, but that, you know, do you remember in the comics, not in like comics as we know now, Iron Man or whatever, but in the older comics, you'd be reading, and there'd, you know, it would come to some, you know, perilous moment in the comic, and then up in the right-hand corner it would say, meanwhile, dot, dot. And then they would go somewhere completely else, and you would be relieved from the feeling you had in your stomach that something bad was going to happen, and then somehow they would miraculously come back, and either, you know, they had gotten out of that trouble, or it just didn't seem so bad, so you had a renewed energy to get, you know, off the ledge with the little branch with the tiger and the sharks, and that's why I write. Well, I mean, it's meanwhile. You know, I'm like, I'm living. I'm like, oh, shit. I don't know what to do. I'll write. And then somehow I write something and I come back and it doesn't seem so perilous. Mm-hmm. So it's really like, you know, writing myself out of a scrape.
Mm-hmm. What made you decide to put it together as a book?
I didn't really. I mean, to be completely honest, I never wrote one word of that with the thought of somebody reading it. I don't think I would have done it if I was going towards that. But this guy, David Auerbridge, just would not leave me alone. I say that, you know, with all fondest affection, because he wrote me letters through my agent starting 11 years ago. And I never responded. I never returned one of the letters. They were like, I read your interviews. Do you know you have a book in you? And I'm like, this is, you know. And then I get this call from Liv Ullmann, one of my heroes in life, you know, and one actually that when I read her book was sort of a transformational experience for me as an actress. It gave me so much, you know, I thought. And she said, why are you not returning my friend's call? And it turned out he had edited that book.
Oh.
And, you know, this is ignorance through lack of investigation. And so I met up with David, and he said, you know, you have anything? And I said, well, I have written a few essays, you know, sort of I called them essays because they have a beginning and a middle and an end, but I have no reason for writing them. Once in a while, I wrote the foreword to a book because it was kind of fun and I was interested in the subject. And so I sent him the stuff I had written, and, you know, that we were off. And every time he would come down from Maine, where he lives, And we would have this sort of, you know, bull session, and then I would write something out of it, because I'd get so mad at him. And I would think, well, secretly, you know, he's having a good time. He seems to be doing what he loves. I make him dinner. We go somewhere, you know, I pay for the theater, whatever. I don't owe him anything. I don't have to write it. I don't have to get this book published. We're just having a process. We're making a book, like, you know, fake.
Whoops.
Yeah. And last year, still at the same place, you know, just writing along. And he said, I'm going to put this in some kind of order. I said, fine, that'd be fun. You know, let's see what. And he was diagnosed with, you know, a disease that looks like it's going to take his life. And it was a kick in the pants. It was like, oh, I see. He said, Winger, I want to see this book out in the world before I die.
Is he Jewish?
No. I think just by contact, you know. So I said, okay, well, even when I walked into the publishers, I thought, nobody's ever going to buy this thing. And then I'll be able to say to him, sorry, David. So after Simon & Schuster bought it, it's just been like that. I would love to say, you know, I had a vision for this book. I went after it and achieved it. I, like, went kicking and screaming. But I'm proud of it. I mean, it's really something to have made it, and I think I want to do it again. So if, you know, anybody buys it, I'll probably be able to.
Bye.
That's the way I look at it now. That's why I'm here. Because, you know, I'm such a big one for self-promotion.
Well, what's it like being out in the world with a book as opposed to with something that's really your own creative impulse?
Intermittently is totally wonderful. Like, mostly when I'm meeting y'all or, you know, signing and people are talking or telling me stories, and then it sucks. The other part sucks.
Which part sucks?
You know, where, not this. I don't know, just, you know, doing an interview and they say, mm-hmm. So where have you been? Mm-hmm. And are you going to have a comeback? And wait, I'm thinking of all the key phrases. What's it like to be in the limelight again? When you were on the silver screen, getting the running grain here, they're all words that have no basis in reality. They send me to my OED, and I'm going, where does limelight come from? Oh, they had lime in the footlights of the theater. Okay, you know, that's the most interesting I can find about it. The last thing I want to do is, like, if silver screen, oh, that's mercury that used to be in the... Because otherwise, I'm just like, I can't tell you how boring I find the whole idea of the celebrity, you know, this whole. Is that going to, like, send you right into a bunch of movie questions?
Well, because I've got all of these questions here about celebrity, because that's really what interests me so much.
I don't want to say, I've done these now. This is my fifth city on my little tour, and every time I have the questions and answers afterwards, they're mostly all about the movies, and that's where I like them to come from. So don't feel that if you have some burning question about Richard Gere that you can't ask.
I did say she was generous.
I just don't like the person that's, you know, in conversation with me.
Well, I'm, you know, sadly, my tastes run to the literary, and I'm fascinated, and the artistic, and I'm really fascinated. I mean, as an actor, you're interpreting somebody else's material, and hopefully you're living deeply within that material, and you're bringing it to life, and, you know, and giving it something more than what it was originally on the page. But it is...
Or less, as the case may be.
As the case may be. But it is a much more co-creative process artistically. As a writer, it's you and only you. And I'm...
Not really. My family might differ, and if beg to differ, especially my sons. I mean, it's my perspective, but where would I be without the people I live with and the people I've met? You know, I'm writing observationally, so I'm not writing in a vacuum. I didn't write, this time out, I did not write fiction, although my family might say I did. historical fiction, I'm calling it. That's where it could be in Barnes & Noble. historical fiction. What was the question?
Who knows? Is there a pleasure in really? I mean, you pick up a book and it's your own words. It's your own.
Oh yeah,
you well, created it.
It,
it,
got,
it
shut
it
me up. That was the good.
It shut you up.
Yeah. I mean, you have to be pretty quiet to write, and I had spent so many years doing this, you know, so I really liked the fact that I could go for a whole day and, you know, not talk to a human. Mm-hmm. That was amazing for me. It's really amazing for my family, you know.
Do you feel something special when you read your own words out loud? I mean, do you have a connect to it? Does it?
No, it honestly depends on who I'm, where I am, and what the feeling in the room is. So I guess in that way, it's not much different than films. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always, it's a communication. So for me, I pretty much read everything to my husband first. And I could kind of bounce off of that, and then David Outerbridge. And so it was always still a communication. There are many things that didn't make it into the book. And in fact, I was pretty harsh on myself editing. It was double this size, actually. So the choice was to, I felt, to see editing as a distilling process rather than just a cleaning up.
So does that mean there's a second volume?
Well, no, I would never use what I wrote, you know, for this. But it was amazing what you could pare away. And, you know, probably that's strong with movies today. So there's a lot that could have been pared away.
How do your kids feel about your sort of putting some?
They like me some days, and some days they don't.
I mean, you're very careful around the family. You're very careful around all of that stuff here.
But oh, you mean talking about? Well, I mean, they just really don't care. I mean, they really don't, they're not, you know, impressed, for sure. You know, no, they're not impressed at all. My little one poses a little bit of a problem because he was the one that came along really after I stepped way back. And so he wasn't on a lot of movie sets. Mm-hmm. And he seems to like movies a little too much for me. So my oldest one, you know, was on movie sets all the time and just, you know, could care less. So it's kind of funny, you know, I didn't expose the little one enough. And it's kind of like getting, you know, a little bit of the, like you get a vaccine, you get a little bit of the disease. I didn't vaccinate him appropriately.
Now, you're kind of working with your husband these days. You said you were sort of developing some
projects
together.
We're working together.
Yeah.
In our house.
Yes.
Well, we've done some things together. We made a film called Big Bad Love, as you said, together. I produced it, and he wrote and directed it, starred in it. And I did a role in it as well. And we have optioned T.C. Boyle's Drop City, which we hope to make sometime this year, start at least. And he has a couple of original screenplays that, you know, we're revving up for. So yeah, I'm ready to go out there and cut me. I actually now it's not that funny these days, because if you take it literally, you know, that's what actresses are doing. They're all in boxing matches in the corner going, cut me.
Is there a sense, though, I mean, it seems that coming back and being able to do this as a family, where you've really lived together as a family, where you've really created a life that is about being a family. I mean, living on a farm together, you guys are...
Oh, we're not, yeah, but we don't do that. First of all, these were about years that are not now, where we have the farm still, but we're not there full time. And when I was just, you know, able to homeschool and stay away from everything. But now we're living a little bit different. But it's what writing is selecting out things that resonate with the other thing. And so, you know, it's almost like stepping stones across. It's not like there's not a whole other thing happening. Mm-hmm. It's just that these are the stones that take you across this particular body of water. But, you know, I never meant to say I'm, you know, out in the country. And there were so many other things that happened. This is what I chose to write about. You know, for the most part, there are a bunch of Hollywood stories in there, too. I just sound like a country bumpkin in Hollywood. That's it.
which is very refreshing. I guess my question around that really was, what's it like to be moving back out into film, back out into sort of that kind of thing, doing it sort of on your own terms with the people you choose to be doing it with, where you kind of have, you know,
well, that's not necessarily going to be true. I have no idea how it will happen, and, you know, if only. I think every filmmaker would tell you, if only you could do it that way. I mean, maybe there are a few that do, Jim Jarmusch, or, you know, people that remain pure to that. But if you want to get out there, and I'm, you know, Drop City is not a small film. Believe me, I'll be, you know, I'll be dancing with partners, you know, that all different kinds of people. So I don't know yet, you know, and I don't see it as, it's so hard for me, this concept of back and, you know, into the swing of things. Where is it? I mean, I'm staying here. I'm looking at, where is L.A.? You know, you can't even, you know, we go out in the street in New York, and I'm not trying to be snobby or say it, but it is different. You know, something happens, you run out into the street, and you see a bunch of other people, and you go, what just happened? And then you talk about it, and then if there anything needs to be done, you run over there and you do it. And in L.A., I driving in the car, I came up from San Diego, and it was like, stop and go. I kept thinking, well, we'll get out of the traffic jam and then we'll drive. So wild to me, because I grew up here. You went to San Diego. It was like a family outing. You drove and you looked at some farmland and then you were in another place. But that's changed a lot. So I'm not sure what people mean when they say, so you're going to come back? No. Where? Give me a map. So I don't know. You know, the business is spread out all over. People are making films from Minnesota. You know, they have their development and their production companies all over the place. I don't know. There are, you know, venture capitalists that are funding films from Wisconsin. So I'll let you know after I do it. But I don't think I'm like necessarily walking down the halls of the studio looking for Sam Goldwyn. You know.
I think I'm.
Although I may.
It's time for questions, but I just want to say one other thing. I think when people are asking, when are you going to come back, or is it coming back, I think it's that you're a presence that's been missed on the screen.
Oh, well, thanks for
no,
saying
that. No, I really mean that. You're. And that's not Hollywood.
I look forward to finding the thing that, you know, makes me feel enthusiastic about it.
Good. Well, so do we. I think it's time for some questions from the audience. We'll be doing this in an orderly
methodically,
way.
Methodically, don't
we
trample the person next to you.
We have two people with a burning question. I think maybe we have to. No. Please wait till you have the.
Are you from Cleveland Heights, Ohio? Or have you ever lived there?
Do you have a subpoena? You're not supposed to answer that because they can come up with an envelope.
Another burning question. This gentleman down here.
First of all, Ms. Winger, thank you for giving me the permission to ask a less than literary Hollywood kind of question. I'm so relieved.
We'll spice things up here.
The only chance I'm going to probably ever get to address you, and I have this question about your work that's slightly literary. I listened to a lot of books on tape, and one of them that I really enjoyed was your work on Philip Roth's The Human Stain. When I went to see the very unfortunate film that was made from it.
I didn't say that. He did. You'll see, you could Google this tomorrow and I will have said that.
One of the things that just struck me as eerie was that Nicole Kidman had essentially adopted your performance. And, you know, that's my view, if she wants to sue me. But have you seen it? Have you noted that? It's
no, Philip made me promise not to see it.
It's very unfortunate.
Well, I mean, you know, I just think it's a really big problem, adaptation, because I think we struggle with, I mean, you know, my husband read the book, Human Stain. That was Arliss's voice. I did a small part in it, and he did a wonderful job. And I think that in adapting, and we just finished the process once again, but when we did Big Bad Love, you really have to get free. of the material in a, you have to make it your own at the same time if you don't understand the essence of it. And I think maybe sometimes where the bigger studio problem is that, you know, they get into who's going to sell the tickets, who's going to have people in the seat the first day, or who they believe is going to. And sometimes even for the actor, it's just a wrong-headed move. I'm not saying on this one because I don't know. I could name a bunch of other ones. But I just look at a movie and I say, why? Why this actor with that film? And I think for me, I was always afraid that I wasn't right for something. And I was always getting the director's lists of actors that could play it better than me. But eventually, if you really do understand that you're the best one for the role, it ignites you. And I thankfully never found myself in something I thought I was horribly miscast in, but it must be a bad feeling. Part of the reason that I wanted to stop making movies was because I felt I was being asked to play younger than I looked, or that I felt I looked. And, you know, you reach your sell-by date on Perky and... Plucky, all those words.
You take one back up there.
Hi. I first wanted to make a little bit of an anecdotal statement. So when I was 6 years old, before I went to bed, I asked my dad if I was related to anyone famous. And he said yes. And I was like, what's her name? Or what's this person's name? And he said, Deborah Winger. So you are my cousin. And I've never actually, I've heard about you all throughout my life, and I've never actually met you.
Is your father my first cousin?
He's your second cousin.
No, I have 63 first cousins.
Oh, wow. I wish I had that. I have not one. But your grandfather and my great-grandfather were cousins.
All right.
So I wanted to make that statement since you're
What's your name?
My name is Jacqueline Beck. We're the Becks.
Oh, okay. I know the Becks.
You know the Becks.
It's legitimate.
It's totally legitimate. So, yeah, I just wanted to say hello for the first time.
This has happened to me in every single city I've gone to.
No.
Yes.
Oh.
I love it.
Okay.
Every city I've gone to in the Q&A, it's kind of funny. It's kind of like a funny little film I could have made. Somebody says, I'm your cousin.
So
I need to introduce all of you.
We should have a family reunion.
Oh, God, can you imagine?
Yeah, it would be amazing.
I'll end up paying for it. No.
And my grandmother always would talk about how she danced at Noah's bar mitzvah with Noah. So
this is getting too personal.
I know. Sorry. Felt like sharing that.
Let's move on. Right down here.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hi. So let me start with my point of relation to you. I'm also Deborah, D-E-B-R-A, and I've always had a thing for your work, and I love Shadowlands. I have since the get-go, and many others. But in any case, and I had a weird moment when you spoke about Liv Ullmann just a few moments ago. Please give me permission to ask you to speak a little bit about some other of your fellow actors who you admire and were inspired by. And I had made a little short list. I wrote Liv Ullmann, Betty Davis, Ingrid Bergman.
Wait, you made a list for me?
No. I was thinking about asking the question. And then moments after I wrote that little short list, you mentioned Liv Ullmann. But anyway,
I think I wasn't one of these. I wasn't taken to the, we didn't go to the movies, you know, when I was little all that much. I don't know why, whatever. It wasn't a big part of our lives. My family didn't troop off to the movies. I remember maybe a couple of films when I was young. So I didn't sit there idolizing, and I certainly never wanted to do that. I never thought about, oh, what if I could do that? Just didn't have that. I was totally on a different road when, you know, this happened. But I certainly admire performances by those actresses, and I guess that's what I looked at once I started pursuing this. I would watch performances, and Betty Davis in Human Bondage is like one of my favorite performances, and certainly Ingrid Bergman has just got an amazing almost neutrality that allows you to pour yourself into her in her roles. And but, you know, up until and including recently, I see Julie Christie in Away With Her. It's just like an amazing performance. So I'm a more of a performance-oriented fan. And most of them are men, but I did manage to come up with four.
You were speaking earlier this afternoon with Pat Morrison about the aging process and the fear, at least in Los Angeles, that many women are afraid to look their age. Can you talk more about how you see the aging process?
No, I didn't even want to talk about it the first time. What do you want me to talk about? Like what? I mean, I don't know because I honestly don't live here, and I haven't been here a lot. I guess it's probably closest to the Upper East Side in New York. That way, there's a big emphasis on the physical here, including your car, right? It extends out to your car.
So how do you separate yourself then from that the image of how women are supposed to look and how you are experiencing your process?
Well, I don't read a lot of magazines. I think that's helpful. I think if you thumb through those magazines, you're cooked because they're selling you something and you're going to eventually, subliminally, you're going to buy it. So I try to stay away from those. I travel to countries other than the United States, it's true, where people look real and 50-year-old women look like 50-year-old women, and it gives me so much heart. They're so beautiful. They have the stories of their lives on their faces, and I have slowly fallen in love with that. And sometimes if they have hardship, that hardship is on their face, but it's beautiful. So I don't know anymore how to even speak the language because aging is so many different things, and we're telling a story with our faces. So, you know, I believe me, it's not easy. I do have a theory that with each birthday, one should give away a mirror from the house so that by the time you're at an age when you might find it very disturbing, you just have a very small mirror above your sink to make sure that there's no spinach in your teeth. This is, I don't know if I'll be able to do it, but I'm working on this idea.
This gentleman down over here. Yeah. We just wait for the microphone to
come. I bet I could hear you without it, but yeah. So.
Well, Ms. Winger, it's an honor to be here today and to address you. First of all, I was very inspired. It was either on PBS or NPR. You were in China, as I recall, with a lot of passion, I believe, on a pursuit of pandas.
Just keep it at in China with passion, because that's good.
Well, it was very true. And
Ang Lee film.
if you could speak a bit about that, but I also have to put a second part to speaking to you, question B, which has been burning, and it's quite special to...
I have a salve.
And let's see which question you'll answer first. Hopefully I'll hear a bit about both. The other one being the information that we've heard through the years that you had a very horrible rapport with Shirley MacLaine on the set.
I think that's an oxymoron, horrible rapport, but I'm not sure.
A lack thereof. That's about it. If you could address both, I'd be very grateful. Thank you.
Shirley and I had, I believe, one of the most appropriate relationships to bring you that film. If you like that film, I just don't know how else we would have done it. We were, you know, walking a walk that was recorded on film. I have nothing but respect for her and vice versa, but it doesn't really sell magazines. And we have absolutely both have big mouths. So we've both been guilty of the barb. And it's fun, and I, you know, I'll keep doing it. I'll give you something tonight, I'm sure. But what was the other thing? Something that was stinging.
Panda's passion, China.
Oh, that was. I was computing when you said that, and that was 8, 10, 13 years ago. I made a film in China called In the Wild, and we were in pursuit, ostensibly, of the panda, wild panda, but given China at that time, and I'm not sure that too much has changed, there was a lot of red tape. And it, so it ended up being a little bit more political than we intended, but yeah, I liked it as well. It was an amazing experience to be able to make documentaries. I still love it. My son has since had a passion for it and is actually leaving to make a documentary tomorrow of his own that he's filming and, you know, found the money for and raised the money for, I should say. Found sounds like he might have stolen it. So I think it had a profound effect on him. But I think it's available. You can get it. And it's really, it is sort of an interesting study about what happens, how a country can co-opt the wildlife. They, you know, China used the panda for so much of their, you know, they sold it, the image of it to the World Wildlife and to having Avion Water, I don't know. And here they were slicing their habitat in half, you know, by deforesting. So I think, you know, for me that was a very interesting thing to see how the geopolitical thing affects wildlife. And, you know, it was a learning experience. And the pandas are really cute.
Yeah. Hi. Hi. Can you tell me if you're working on your second book, and if so, what it's about?
It's about tonight. Y'all.
You feature prominence.
I think, you know, I am always writing, so it'll just, you know, I would love to think that I could write some fiction. I think that interests me, so we'll see what happens.
Okay. Is there anything from this corner?
So we're going to have a dog pile in the middle to see who they those
Let me
two
take
are.
This lady right over here, and then we'll... Oh.
Hi. Just a quick comment. My husband and I recently rented Shadowlands. It had been on my list for years, and we'd never gotten to it. And we were just so moved by it. Just a wonderful, really touched us.
It is a really beautiful film. I say that, you know, with distance. I haven't seen it in a while, but I know that it was, you know, very well made. I know how good the script was, and it didn't really get as... It came out the same year, I think, as Remains of the Day, and Anthony had gotten so much...
Yeah.
That came out first, and he had gotten so much attention for that. In fact, I think he got nominated for it, that I think it kind of fell in the shadow of that, but it is a lovely film,
it
and
really
I love
was.
C.S. Lewis, so it was wonderful to
it
research.
It really, really just took us the night we watched it. But my question to you is, what's your favorite film of your own? Which one means the most to you?
I haven't made it yet.
Okay. So then I guess we will see a comeback.
It was inevitable.
How'd she get there?
But seriously, you don't have one over the other that you really enjoyed making or
They're really all such, you know, expressly different experiences. Some, you know, you love the end product more than you love the process. Some you love the process more. Some a little of both, some a lot of both. There isn't one that, you know, just, oh, by and, you know, far beyond everything. And I really dream that, you know, that's still to happen because maybe so, a lot of things I'm interested in will come together in one film, not just as an actress.
This gentleman over here.
Just out of curiosity, Ms. Winger, have you ever done a voice for The Simpsons?
No, have you heard me on it? No. That was really easy. That would be a yes or no question.
It would be
all right,
a yes or
so
no question.
We're almost done.
We're almost done, but I wanted you, because you read so beautifully, if you would read. Wow,
my third grade teacher said that,
yes,
too.
Yes, well, you do. So there you are. Just, I had one little piece that I thought sort of summed up a lot about
Is
the book.
Is it depressing?
It's very depressing.
I like that she's written start here.
And.
We're coming into the middle of something, but as with all transformations, there are certain qualities that return to a familiar, habitual way, but the gentle shifting is seismic and affects the whole of one's life. It occurs to me now that so much of acting is undoing. At least for me it is. I seek to go to the edge of what I can know about a situation or a life and then undo the rest of me. Set it free. When I was first starting out and heard all the stories of actresses being discovered, I decided I loved the word, but not for what it had come to mean to others. I loved it in a real-life sense. I have a photograph of myself at about 23, foot up in the air, arms open to the universe, proudly wearing a tight t-shirt that reads, Undiscovered. I saw my life and my pursuits as an uncovering of who I could not know I was until then. My young life had not supported such daring, and the examples were not in evidence. If I was to end up in places I could not yet imagine, I needed to undo some of my thinking.
Thank you.
Anyway, thanks for being a great audience. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.